welcome back to another exciting episode of Exhibition. We have a fabulous guest. Third time. Chris Esper's here with this new short, Michael Solis. Welcome. Solis?
Yep, Solis. You got it. Yep.
Solis. Okay. I was shocked. You didn't write this.
No, I did not write this one. No.
What's going on here? That seems to be your thing.
Yeah, well, so one of the other shorts I did show you, Undertaker, I didn't write that one either. That was written by Chris Salvi, who also wrote Michael Solis.
This one.
So, so, I mean, I don't always direct things I write. I mean, it's lately I have been, but this one fell into my lap and I'm like, oh, I have to make this. I mean, because it did feel like something that I would write. So it's, so it spoke to me in that way. So I'm like, okay, this feels... It felt like something I would write. Chris even said first of all, there was another director attached to it before I came along, and that director unfortunately was no longer able to make it. So then Chris approached me and said, "Would you want to do this?" And I read it and I said, "Holy shit, this feels like something I would write." But not only does it feel like something I would write, it feels like something. It's just something that I would want to watch. So it was those two reasons I said, absolutely, I'm in. So, yeah, I did not write it, but I wish I did. But
so I have a question. Coming on, okay, Undertaker is the one with the guy in the bus?
No, that's Imposter. Undertaker was black and white, and it was about the man that wakes up at the train tracks, and he is...
We did two of the same day. I know we did both those on the
that's
same
right.
day. We did
that's
one,
right.
and we did the other. So I had to remember which one it was.
Okay. That's okay. That's okay. Yeah.
So... in doing that, is this a paid gig for you, or is this just like, hey, I like this, let me do this?
No, it's just, hey, I like this, let me do this
Okay.
kind of situation. Yeah.
Because, I mean, you are a man of work for hire, last time I checked.
I am. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So sometimes you're like, I'll do this on the cheap.
Yeah.
I got it.
No, I mean, in this case, I not only directed it, I was also the producer, so I was also... you know, finding the money slash also putting the money in. So what, well, I virtually paid for the whole thing, basically, with the exception of one very generous funder who was one of my executive producers. She was kind enough to give me some money too. But yeah, I funded, so because I was also funding it, because I was that passionate about it, I fund all my movies, but...
I know you do.
Yeah, so in any event, yeah, it's one of those things where when you're a filmmaker... that's also producing it, you're the last person to see any kind of dime. If anything, you're losing money. So to which someone will ask, well, then why do it? And then they're like, what's the reward? I'm like, well, the reward is in the work. You know, the reward is the work, expressing yourself, getting it out there and finding an audience. And then, you know, then you make the next one, which will then give you money. I mean, plus with short films, you're not looking to make money. You're just looking to hone your craft and then make that feature, which then can make you money, perhaps. You know, it's unpredictable. Nobody knows.
I gotta say, I want people to know what you do. Chris is like, I don't know how to say, jack of all trades. I mean, I want people to know you do everything. I've seen other work you've done for other people, and the amount of work you can do on 10 cents is amazing.
Oh, thank you.
And you do see that throughout this film, which I'm going to get to in a few seconds. So
sure.
I am prepping you up for this.
Okay.
So let's start at that. I mean, the prep work you had to do to start off the film. And I want to break down for the main character's glasses I want to talk about here. And I want to talk about his tie.
Okay.
Now, those could not have been easy things to find. I think you had to work for them. So walk me through those processes.
Sure. Yeah. So in the case of the costume, so to make another connection here, Gabrielle Rawson, who you had on the show, I've worked with her numerous times on many projects. I was her director of photography on at least three or four projects at this point, including Fool's Gold, which she had talked about on your show. I've been an editor for her films as well. So she was my production designer for Michael Solis, and she's really good at conceptualizing colors and knew exactly what I was looking for. I mean, our references. So one of the things I try to do with every movie I make is I always give homework to cast and crew. I say, okay, you're going to watch these three movies to get an idea of the vision that
Oh
I'm.
no, you can't just, you gotta give me the three movies.
Oh,
You
I am
can't
going to give
just,
it to you. I
okay,
am.
good.
Yeah,
You know
I
I'm
am going to give it to
asked.
you. Yeah. So I said, okay, you're going to watch these three movies. And the three movies are Barton Fink, Naked Lunch by David Cronenberg, and the 1922 version of Nosferatu. I said, those are the three movies you're going to be watching. So that was the assignment. So the outfit is very much inspired by John Turturro's character in Barton Fink.
Absolutely, it is.
Yeah.
Now you've told me, I totally see it.
Yep. So we specifically went for the same kind of colors, and the cinematography was very akin to that as well. So yeah, no, we were heavily inspired by Barton Fink and Naked Lunch, because both characters, the funny thing about those two movies, they're both about writers. They both take place in the 40s. They both share a lot of browns, reds, kind of color palettes, and golds. And they both have characters that have these same sort of brown suits. And most importantly of all, Judy Davis is in both movies as the female love
Yes,
interest. It's
she
very,
is.
and like that wasn't even intentional. I watched both movies back to back and I'm like, oh wow, there's a lot more similar here than I realized. But yeah, we very much took a lot of cues from that, and then we crafted the costume to be specific for our own vision rather than just doing a carbon copy. So we watched those three movies. I also at least for the performance, I told Justin, who played Michael Solis, to also think about Nicolas Cage in Adaptation, who is a very nervous writer in that movie, and and Michael's a very neurotic writer himself. So yeah, I pulled from everywhere I could to just give a complete vision of like, okay, if you want to know what this movie is, watch those movies. So that's what we did.
So, in seeing this short, if somebody's made it this far in the interview and had not seen the short, should they go back and watch those three films, or it's not needed?
It's not needed, I would say. It's just more of like they were just influences for me. I have influences for all my movies, and I think that's kind of nice because in a way you kind of have to go back to know what came before to sort of understand what are you crafting and how you're gonna bring the trajectory further in cinema, because I mean even the people who made those movies, they had influences too, I mean, so it's just always perpetuating, influences upon influences. This person was inspired by this person, then someone else was inspired by a filmmaker of the 30s and 40s, and before them, the filmmakers of the early 1900s. I mean, so it's always perpetuating. I think it's important to understand film history and to just like, go back and know where it started, like, and how what you can do to put your own spin on that voice, of your own voice, I should say.
How come you always make shorts and never a full film?
I'm actually endeavoring to do a feature now. I think it was just a lot of things. I mean, one is getting money. That's the big thing. But I think a lot of it too is that whole idea of like, oh, am I ready? Am I really ready now? Like, can I do this? Like, it's a big. I think for me, I think for years I've built up the idea of doing a feature as like being this like thing where it's like, oh, you only have one feature film debut. It's got to be as great as it could be, and I think I've sort of put it on a pedestal, probably more than I probably needed to. But I think now I'm at a point where I'm like, okay, I'm ready to do one, and I do have two feature film screenplays I did write that I'm hoping to get made. So yeah, it's definitely on the docket. But now that I've made many films for 15 years, I'm like, okay, I'm good. I think I know what I can do now.
I want to go back to the restaurant scene where we open up.
Okay.
First off, I want to start with what restaurant it was. You can start there, and then I'll give you the part two after.
Sure. The restaurant was called Sarto's Restaurant. It was in Providence, Rhode Island, right in downtown.
Okay, was it, are those all extras or is it open?
No, those are all extras.
Okay,
Yep.
now this is where I want people to notice you are a master editor and a master of sound.
Thank you.
How many sh edits did you do in that opening shot? And if you tell me only one, you're full of crap. Because it's edit. I count at least 15.
Oh yeah, no, there was a lot of edits for that. I mean, I'll talk about too the scene that comes after the restaurant because that was an edit at
Okay,
night. Well, not in the
lead me
night.
into
Well,
that.
yeah, I'll lead into that in a bit. But yeah, with that particular scene, so the restaurant was closed for the day first, so we had the whole place to ourselves. So,
Did you have to rent that restaurant or they just gave it to you for the day?
nope, we
Okay.
rent. Yep, we rent. Actually, well, so we rented it, but we got it for a very reduced rate, and in exchange, they also provided us some food. So, I mean,
Nice.
it was a good sort of twofold situation. And so, yeah, we were there for the whole day, and basically, I just we just captured as many shots as we could get because I mean, we had the time, we were able to do it, and the dialogue scenes were very short, thankfully, so it allowed us to do the dialogue portions and then go in, get our background cast, and then release them, and then just get whatever inserts we wanted, and then we were out of there. I think we got there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and we were out of there by 6 o'clock, not even. So I mean, it wasn't
But
too bad.
okay, I'm not letting you off that easily. There's more work to be done here.
Yeah.
You start off with a two shot,
Yeah.
and then you switch to a side shot, and then you edit back, and then you edit back. And then, I mean, walk me through that process.
Okay.
How many different times did you shoot the same shot? How
So
many
we,
times did you shoot the
yeah.
back out extras? And then you have close-ups added in.
Yep.
I want to get into all
So,
that.
okay, gotcha. So I did. I want I because we were dealing with background cast and there's a lot of people there. I'm very conscious about people's time and how long people are there for, especially if they don't have to be there for 12, 14 hours. Like I try to be very conscious of people's time and where they're coming from. So I tried to do I did I think I want to say I did at least 3 to 4 takes per shot at the most. So if you consider too that that scene was actually shot twice because that scene appears twice in the movie in
Yes.
different in a different in two different variations. So we would do scene one, let's say. We did the master shot, the two shot, like 3 takes, and then while we were in the same position, the same lighting setup, I said, okay, let's switch over to scene six. We're already lit for this side of the world. Let's now
Is
switch
scene
gears.
six the last shot?
That
Okay.
last. The other restaurant scene, right?
Yes.
So we basically did the wide shot for that scene as well, and then likewise did the over the shoulders pretty much the same way, where I said, okay, we're gonna do the over the shoulder on Justin, and we're gonna do it for scene one, 3 takes of that. Scene six, 3 takes of that. Switch over to Diana, get her coverage, and do the same thing there. Which was interesting because, I wanted people to watch the movie and think, are they using the same footage again, or is this different, or is this a different performance? And it was a different performance, but I tried to do it in a way where it was sort of the same thing but different, and I kept the shots the same too for that reason, because I really wanted to feel like a repeat of what we saw and like really confuse the audience momentarily and think, okay, was that reality? Was that fantasy? And so that was the decision there. And then basically hopping around the restaurant and just getting close-ups of our various background casts. And I would say with that, I'd say about 2 takes per person. I mean, they only had like one or two lines, if anything. And we were like, I was constantly switching lenses. I would say to my cinematographer, I would say, okay, let's pop on the 50 millimeter and get a close-up of someone's mouth, or, let's grab the 85 and get eyes and, whatever, or plates. So, yeah, I mean, we grabbed everything, and I mean, there was a lot I didn't use in the edit. So it was just basically it was getting enough coverage so that I could craft the scene and craft the story. The idea there was to show Michael's neuroses, with seeing so many people.
Okay. How long did it take you to edit that all together then? I mean, that looks time consuming.
It was. I mean, I wanted to say that scene alone, it took me, well, I'm a pretty quick editor, so I'd say the rough cut part of it took me about a day, and then refining it, I would refine it and keep refining it and keep refining it, and then so I would say I was refining it up until the last day that I needed to finish it, because I kept going back and I kept saying, okay, yeah, no, I would say, oh, what if we put this shot here? What effect would that make? Or if I put this one here, what does that do for the following shot? Editing is like writing, for me. The way you write a scene in the script, you're also rewriting it in the edit. I did that with Distant Memories, the last film I showed you. That was the way that film played out. That was not the same order that I had written the script. It wasn't until editing that I realized, wait, this doesn't work. And then I switched it and I said, oh, wow, that's much better. So you discover new things when you're editing.
Yeah, I mean, okay. Now, we're gonna get into some more, guys. I'm a big Chris fan. I'm sorry. I just gonna be a gush fest for me, but he knows that already. Because I've seen your other work and I know how your stuff works. Your adding of sound, I really want to get into that, especially when you blend your music and your sound effects.
Oh, yeah.
I'm so shocked as a guy that's seen your films from the beginning till now, how much you've grown as a filmmaker.
Oh,
So
thanks.
how did you develop that sound? Because I'm talking the axe dragging, and then you have the music coming in, and it's all as one. So I mean, basically, I'm trying to think, not, sound effects and the thing. I know one's a creation of sound and one's not. You should be up
Yeah.
for an Oscar for that sound. It is so good.
Yeah, I can't take credit. I mean, so I'll put it this way. When I do my edit, I always put my own sound effects as like a guide baseline, because
Right.
particularly with this movie, I was so, and also with Distant Memories, those two movies, they were very much driven by sound. And so I would grab my own sound effects from a sound effects library and just use them as a basis for where I wanted to cut and how I wanted to cut it and what emotional impact I wanted it to have. That was important too, because I needed that baseline for my sound designer and mixer, Jay Sheehan, who's brilliant. He also did the sound mix on Fool's Gold for Gabby. And he's just such a talented guy. I mean, he's been doing it for like 30 years or something like that, and he knows what he's doing. So I mean, I gave him a sort of a baseline, and he refined it. He added a lot of different reverb effects and delays, things that I did in my own edit too, but he just like enhanced it even more. So I did my own, and then I said to him, I said, here, use this as a baseline, but play with it a little bit, clean it up, do anything you have to do to it to make it better. And so that's what he did. Yeah, I grabbed a lot of sound effects from sound effects libraries, and I had temporary music underneath, like sort of the music that the sound alike of what I thought I wanted. I took music from Eyes Wide Shut, for example, because it was the type of music I wanted.
I
And
can
so,
see that.
yeah. So I took music from that film and I laid it underneath a couple of the scenes, and I would go and I went to my composer, Jimmy Jackson, who also produced the movie, co-produced it with me. I said, this is the vibe I'm looking for. And so when I got the music and the sound put together, sent it over to Jay, and then he did the full mix from there on out.
The man dragging an axe is such a distinctive look. I mean, I know what it means in the film, but I'm thinking maybe it might be something the writers actually felt of the script.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
Yeah.
I totally think I mean, you shot it beautifully. I'm not going
Oh,
into that,
thanks.
but I was just thinking that it's a cathartic of carrying the axe is just so deep for anybody who produces anything, yourself, me,
Yeah.
anybody. And is that the visual we were looking for?
It absolutely is. I mean, and the man who was the stunt coordinator for that scene, my good friend Robert Marcella, he made a good point. He said, you really want to show with the stunt that the pen is mightier than the sword.
Yes.
And that was the idea behind the concept of, well, the script said an axe, and Robert actually did bring a sword to the set. We did try a rehearsal with the sword. I was like, it does work. It's very cool. But the axe, I couldn't get the image of the axe out of my head, so we just used the axe. But he did have a sword, and then the idea of using the pen for Justin to come out and put the pen like this so that he drops in the script. That was not how it was read in the script. Paul takes the axe, goes like this, trips on himself, and hits the wall. And we all thought, okay, that doesn't really work as well. We need something that's a little bit more powerful. So then Robert had this pen, this sort of fountain pen. And so we figured, oh, let's use that. And that just made it a more powerful image, that the pen, or writing, I should say, is what ultimately became Angel Donovan's demise in that scene when he drops dead. It's like the very thing that killed him. The sight of a pen is just like he can't look at a pen anymore. Because you become so consumed with writing that, at least when I'm writing, you'd start to develop the beads of sweat down your forehead as you're trying to figure out what's the next word, but say, what's the right word for this piece of dialogue? What's the right verbiage that you're trying to say? What are you trying to? So it can just feel very daunting to sit in front of a piece of paper or a computer and these days and try to figure out what works best for you as a writer.
Is it a blood capsule in his mouth?
No, actually, with that, we actually just had the makeup artist, she has had like a little cup of blood, and then she just said we would just pour it at the beginning of the take,
Okay.
and then he held it in his mouth, and then on cue he just dropped it, and then that was it.
Now, you shoot that scene outside, coming around a corner, kind of. Was this early in the morning? Did anybody say anything? I always need to know.
No, we actually had a police detail on site, so
Aha.
the city knew what we were doing. A matter of fact, the people that own the restaurant, they own that property of that alleyway, so
Oh.
they knew we were looking for an alleyway, and the woman who was helping me said, "Oh, we have an alleyway down the street, just use that one." I'm like, "Oh, really?" And she's like, "Yeah." I'm
That's
like,
awesome.
sweet. So then, we had to get production insurance. We had to get the police involved to make sure that they knew what was going on. And so the police were on standby and they knew what we were doing. They were stopping cars for us when needed. So, I mean, it was great. It worked out really well.
So let's move on to the night shot. I won't discuss where it happens because I think it's kind of important to the film, so I'm going to leave that out. How was lighting the night shot? And then we'll get to the props next.
So the lighting of it was a pain. It was, oh God, it was awful. Because we were at this location that obviously had no power needs.
Nope.
So we were using battery operated lights, which did work for a bit, but then of course the problem there is like, how do you charge the batteries when they die? So we had these little charging stations, these power boxes, they're called Echo Flows. And we would plug lights in whenever we could to at least have some power. Another one was charging batteries off to the side. Then a third one was nearby plugging in another light. So we had three of these Echo Flows. We couldn't afford a generator, as much as I would have loved to have had one. We couldn't afford it. But it was a nightmare because you were, because then the Echo Flows, they also die because they have to be charged. And when you plug in something that it carries more power than the box could handle, it's not going to last very long.
No.
So we were really running on very, very thin ice with that scene. It was not an ideal situation at all. So, I mean, it took time. We did also did get a little bit of light rain
Oh.
during one of the shots, but the fortunate thing about light rain is that you can't really see it on camera unless it's backlit. So it that wasn't too bad for us. The power stuff, yeah, that was a pain. So we had like, I want to say we had like three or four lights going at once. Like a backlight on the actors and then key light and like a background light, just getting like the trees and things like that. Plus the car had headlights, so I mean that was helpful too.
Oh, look at you. I think. Okay, now we can discuss the masks. The masks are awesome.
Oh, thanks.
You
Yeah.
have five different masks, I think. I think it's five.
Correct. Yep.
Where did they come from? Or did you, they're all plain, you painted them, or what's going on there?
So the script described these demon masked individuals, but the script never said what they looked like. And that was actually my idea to have them be made out of screenplays. So I said to Gabby and Christian Sherman, who is our art director, we discussed it. I said, "Oh, what if the masks are made out of screenplays? It's about a writer." I said, "The dialogue says this is where screenwriters go to die." I'm like, "Oh, how appropriate! They take this. They've taken much like how there are sin eaters or soul eaters. These people take the written works of writers who have passed on or what have you." I thought, oh, what if we just take screenplays, rip them to shreds, make like these paper mache masks, and they're all different colors and they all have different facial expressions and they represent different genres of writing. Like one was a drama mask. It was like kind of blue. And then the yellow one had a big smile. It was comedy. And then, science fiction, period piece, then the horror, which was red. So, and if you look closely at the words on the on the mask, you can't even see written by Chris Esper and written by Chris Salvi on one of them. So
I missed that.
we used pieces of our own script for that. So it was kind of like a neat little Easter egg.
I do want to take a stab at the music. It is very eclectic at times.
Yes.
Like, you say Barton Fink, but I don't, it's more gothic to me than
It
Barton
is,
Fink.
yeah. No, Barton Fink was more for the visuals more than anything else.
Okay.
I'd say for the music, I was more inspired by Eyes Wide Shut, like I said, and
Yes.
yeah, because I did want it to be more. I didn't really want to go for like a because like Barton Fink and Naked Lunch, they have kind of like a jazzy sort of 50s,
Yes.
and that didn't fit this movie. So I thought that something more gothic lend itself better to that. So then, yes, I chose a lot of ambient and a lot of gothic types of music to lay as a temporary score when I was editing. And then when I gave it to Jimmy to do the scoring, he used that very much as a basis for creating his own soundtrack.
Okay, the last shot, I couldn't tell if it was a hotel or an apartment
Ah.
entry. Now, my guess would be it looks like a hotel entrance to me or an old apartment entrance. Or am I totally off base?
You are actually paying me a great compliment when you say it looks like a hotel entry, because that's what I was trying to go for. Actually, no,
Okay.
it's a actually no, it's a theater. It's the lobby of
Is
a
it?
yep, it's a lobby of an old
Okay.
theater. Yep. So there's a pretty well-known theater in Providence, called Providence Performing Arts Center. And I was surprised that they allowed me to shoot there. I mean, it wasn't cheap, believe me, but it had the vision that I was after. Because we needed like an old hotel. I did call real hotels, but of course they all said, "Nope, can't shoot here. It's gonna affect human traffic that's here." And all I said, "Okay, understandable. That's fine."
I disagree. If you shot at 3 o'clock in the morning, it would not affect too
Yeah,
much traffic.
exactly. But it
And if
would have been.
Tom Cruise asked to film it, it'd be no problems.
Yeah, exactly. So luckily this theater had the exact look. It looked like a hotel lobby, and so it gave the exact look that we were going for. And so, yeah, we just used the old theater and just shot around anything that was like sort of theater-esque, like any kind of posters, or we, moved anything that said it was a theater. So we just controlled it as much as we could.
Okay. Is this film, I presume, is on the circuit, though you can't
Yes.
really find it yet? Okay, but
Yeah.
we'll don't worry. We'll give the other part at the end, I promise
Yeah.
you.
Yeah. No, it's just
Okay.
starting on just starting on the circuit. Yeah.
I know you want your fun questions because you've done this so many times. You know I have to make up new ones for you.
No, I love it. Yeah, it's great.
Okay, Chris, your favorite food, and did you serve it at your wedding?
Ooh, that's a good question. My favorite food. I mean, I love to cook. That's my other sort of creative hobby outside of filmmaking.
I don't
But
believe you have time to cook, buddy. I don't believe you have
I
the
you can ask my wife. I make the time somehow,
time.
like
Okay.
in between my day job and all my other things. No, I tend to go for like my favorite food. Oh, I think like anything Italian. I just because I am Ital I'm half Italian.
Know.
So it's I would say. Oof, wow, yeah, that's really tough. I do really like zuppa di pesce, which is like pasta and seafood, like shrimp or mussels, clams, all that. Well, we did not serve it at our wedding, but we did have a really delicious filet mignon, which I do love as
Okay.
well. Yeah, so it's
Number two, your favorite drink, and was it served at your wedding?
my favorite. Yes, it was. My favorite drink is an old fashioned.
Okay.
And
Nice drink.
yep, we have like a his and hers kind of drink. Like her favorite drink is a gin and tonic, and mine's the old fashioned. So we had that at the open bar.
Physical media or streaming, which one do you prefer?
Oh, physical, easily.
Okay, and where everybody can find your lovely work?
My work can be found on my website, which is storiesmotion.com. I am also on Facebook and Instagram at Stories of Motion, or it's also under what is at Chris underscore Esper, and you'll see my work there as well. So yeah, I mean those two films are both Distant Memories of Michael Solis. They're on the festival circuit. Distant Memories is almost done and will be online fairly soon. And Michael Solis is just starting its festival journey.
Okay. Thank you as always. Talk to you again soon.
Yeah, thank you.